So I want to help guide us in this afternoon session in the exploration of how to practice with thoughts and emotions, both in our meditation practice and then pointing towards bringing that understanding of how to work with thoughts and emotions into our speech practice. And I'll give some outline of some suggestions of how to practice, and we'll do at least two exercises together, and also I think have some room for discussion in approximately the next hour. So it'll be some talking, some experiential work, and then some chance to share, debrief, discuss things. One of the interesting aspects about developing in our speech practice, in our communication practice, is that in a way, a lot of the fundamentals that are really crucial for skillful speech practice actually are more about what we do before we open our mouths. And so I like, for example, the way that Oren has this whole section which is framed as attention. It's not framed as talking, right? It's framed as attending to these aspects of experience. And there are ways in which we can see, and I think we've sometimes used this language, Oren, in the past, that in a way, when we get to the actual communication techniques of here's a skillful way to say this or talk about this, it's going to build on everything we've done about tuning into needs, about being, as we'll see in this session, skillful with thoughts and emotions, about developing mindfulness, about ways of developing a kind heart. That if those foundations aren't there, we can have all the great communication skills in the world, and the communication won't necessarily be very skillful. It's interesting, right? So in a way, a lot of the energy here is on building these foundations, mindfulness, loving kindness, tuning into needs, developing intention and working with that, curiosity and care and so forth. That's quite interesting. And the area that I'll be focusing on this afternoon is how do we work skillfully with what we, in the West, call thoughts and emotions. And it's interesting that all of these terms are used in slightly different ways. Interesting also that in the Buddhist context, there actually is no word that directly translates as emotion. Essentially, they carve up experience in a different way. There's a different framework. It's more... It's sometimes done in the West also. We sometimes, sometimes we have the framework that dates at least from Plato and the Greeks of seeing three parts of experience: bodily experience, emotional experience, and more cognitive experience, right? And that's more or less the framework that probably most of us use. Sometimes in the West, it's just been mind and body, right? And emotion kind of gets brought into mind. And the framework in the Buddhist cultures is more that what we call thought and emotion are brought into one category, and then the physical is in a second category. So it's interesting. So even to talk about mindfulness of thoughts and emotions is making a translation. You know, it's talking in really in our language. Being skillful and aware of thoughts and emotions is vital for our speech practice, so that we are not simply tossed around by whatever our thoughts or emotions are, that we're not tossed around by our becoming angry or our judgmental mind or our excitement and happiness. And that the emphasis especially is on really knowing well our own patterns, both the ones that are more pleasant and the ones that are less pleasant, and knowing them very well as a key. And also, in doing that, we can have a sense very much of how other people work. If we know our own thoughts and emotions well, we may have a pretty good way to be more empathic and understanding of others if we've studied in depth, you know. And for me, one of the benefits of a longer period of meditation practice is, and particularly doing retreats, is that virtually all of the emotions, including the difficult ones, have come up for sustained periods in meditation practice. And normally we don't necessarily look carefully at them, but for example, one of my early retreats, I had mostly fear for a good period of time, in the retreat. Other retreats, it was bliss and happiness and understanding. So I had enough of a balance, so I got interested, right? There was that retreat. Another retreat, I actually experienced anger virtually nonstop, 18 hours a day for 10 days in a row. It was all in the workable range. That was a blessing, right? So I got to study it. It was pretty interesting. I had never known anger quite like that, right? It didn't match what I thought anger was, right? Yeah, in multiple ways. Another retreat, really studying judgment of others, self-judgment, and so forth, and so forth. Other times when grief has been quite strong, or happiness, calm, equanimity. So meditation is wonderful in that it lets us really stay with these phenomena. I'll talk about thoughts and emotions in a few different ways, and we'll continue with looking at emotions tomorrow. And one thing I want to say initially, and then I think I'll probably come back to it, is that one of the ways that emotions are understood is in the context of NBC, where emotions are understood as quite connected with needs. In other words, when needs are met, there may be a certain range of emotions. And we have that in our packet, right? You can see the way they're presented is that they're presented in relationship to the meeting or the not meeting of needs. So for example, I could be very excited and really passionate related to my need being met for learning and growth and exploration, right? And that emotion in the NBC context is there because a need is being met. And conversely, when needs are not being met, it's natural for certain emotions to arise. If my need for intimacy is not being met, what might my emotions be? Sadness, right? What? Yeah, could be a series, could be sadness, frustration, loneliness, right? And so we'll be tuning into the way that emotions have this strong connection with needs. Or if I'm, let's say, my need for autonomy, let's say, in a work situation is not being met, what might my emotion or emotions be? Might be anger. What? Excuse me? Yeah, it could be anger, resentment, frustration. And my thoughts could go into being judgmental of self or other and so forth. So we'll want to be tracking that relationship, and we'll continue with that. I think I may bring that up later today, and then we'll also explore that tomorrow. Yeah.
What if the feeling that comes up is really strong, and is triggered by something someone says or does, but it really has more to do with the veils of past pain.
The veils of...
of past pain, like childhood stuff.
Yeah. I'll try to weave a response to that question in. The short answer would be, I'm not going to try to answer it in the context of needs and emotions, but yeah, there can be all sorts of ways that emotions manifest. Let me try to weave that in, okay? And I'll have some, we'll have some time for discussion at the end. So one way that Buddhist practice and nonviolent communication share a perspective is in that we really take, in a way, and this would be relevant for your question as well, we take radical responsibility for our experience, right? And so things can be triggered by others, you know, and we can have events happen that trigger certain emotions, but we try to take radical responsibility for our own thoughts and emotions. And I'll say what that means. So for example, one way to frame it is that we are really trying to be responsive rather than reactive. And we may sometimes be reactive, but we want especially to try to be able to be responsive, and ideally in every circumstance, even if I've been triggered, even if past pain from childhood, which is very, you know, of course, very, a lot of our deeper patterns are connected with that past pain, even if that gets triggered, I try to take responsibility for the experience rather than blaming what happened in the past or blaming another person. In Buddhist practice, one way that this is understood is in terms of probably my favorite Buddhist teaching, that I rarely have a retreat in which I don't offer the teaching. So here it is. It's the teaching called the teaching of the two arrows. How many of you know this? Okay, a lot of you. How many of you don't know this teaching? Okay. Here it is. Okay. The Buddha was once basically hanging out with a bunch of monks and nuns, and he asked them, "Everyone experiences the unpleasant. How is a practitioner different from a non-practitioner?" They did not answer him, and so he answered his own question, which was one of his common pedagogical techniques. And he said, yes, everyone at times experiences unpleasant sensations. In the text, he was talking about physical sensations. I think we can generalize it to mean all types of experiences. And this is going back to the morning teaching about the feeling tone, that we all at times experience unpleasant feeling tones. We have unpleasant experiences. We can have unpleasant physical experiences. We get ill, we get injured. Well, we sit in meditation for a little longer than our bodies say is the optimal time, right? And we can have some unpleasant sensations. And similarly, we can have unpleasant emotions. We can have unpleasant interactions where I, you know, maybe, again, in NBC language, one of my needs is not met. I get angry, let's say. I have unpleasant experiences. I'm treated in a way which I don't like, and so forth. And we can also be treated unfairly or unjustly at times. And so in all of that, everyone's the same. Everyone at times experiences unpleasant experiences. Everyone at times experiences unpleasant experiences. Okay, that's not. Sometimes when I give talks, my high school English teacher is above my right shoulder correcting my grammar and word use and so forth. So she made an observation just now. So her name is Miss Baker. She was, she was, anyone have someone like Miss Baker in high school? She was, I learned a lot, but she was generally, you know, employed methods of terror. Okay. And so everyone has at times unpleasant experiences. And the Buddha said that is like being shot by an arrow. He said that's like being shot by the first arrow. And in that, practitioners and non-practitioners are identical, no different. Where the difference is that a non-practitioner, we might say being triggered by the unpleasant experience, will react and will do something that is reactive and compulsive, that, again, very much in line with what Oren was exploring in the talk yesterday in the afternoon, we will tend to react to the unpleasant in some way or other. You know? And the practitioner learns not to do this. So what does that look like to react? That if I'm having unpleasant physical experiences, I may tense around them. I may, you know, if I have unpleasant sensations sitting here in meditation, I may blame myself, or I may judge. I may react verbally through being judgmental. I might judge myself, oh, I should have meditated more last week, so I get ready for the retreat. Or could say, the teachers really were unwise in their schedule. They should have had shorter meditations, right? And we might be reactive that way. We could also maybe say that a little more reasonably, but we might react. And actually, a lot of you know, observers and students of chronic pain have found that as much as 80% of chronic pain is the reaction to the unpleasant sensation in some forms of chronic pain, and not what has to be there necessarily. So not coincidentally, the first medical intervention was with the area of chronic pain, because if you can have people not shoot the second arrow with chronic pain, as much as 80% of the pain might not be there. Right? Quite something. And that's easy to see with emotional reactions. Like something may happen. I may have a difficult interaction with my partner for 15 seconds, and I react about it for the next 3 days. We know that well, right? We know that. We know what shooting the second arrow means interpersonally. Someone's...
What is the shooting the second arrow?
Shooting the second arrow is the reaction.
Like the ruminating?
Yeah, whatever. The ruminating, the reacting, the speaking, the self-judgment, the judgment of others, and so forth. So, you know, that would be an example of shooting the second arrow. And the, you know, same thing could happen if there's injustice or someone has done something that's painful for my group, my nation. Countries shoot second arrows at each other. A lot of conflicts could be understood in terms of shooting second arrows. You know, so all of this is very relevant to working with violence, peacemaking, and so forth. And so what the Buddha suggested was that right at the heart of our practice, and this is actually in some ways a more direct way of talking about the Four Noble Truths in Buddhism, that the aim of practice is to not shoot the second arrow. It's to actually transform reactivity. Another way of talking about that is that we take responsibility for our own experience. I have something unpleasant happening, I try to take responsibility, and it happens on many, many levels. Here's another example of shooting the second arrow. This is a young meditator talking. Today, I will live in the moment, unless the moment is unpleasant, in which case, I will eat a cookie. This is a perhaps less harmful way of shooting the second arrow, but it's still a way of reacting, right? Or not. And so again, as with the instruction this morning, we learn, there are a number of different ways that we could work with this. We learn where the level of the unpleasant is workable and not causing harm for ourselves or others. We learn how to be with that. We learn how to be with sadness or anger or fear or other challenging emotions, which again, for me, before I did that in a sustained way in a meditative context, I had never done that. Some of us may learn that in psychotherapy or have very enlightened parents, whatever. And so there's that sense that we learn not to shoot the second arrow. And I would say the most common guidance that I give in doing one-on-one work with people is that when someone has had something difficult happen, I say, watch your tendency to shoot the second arrow and try not to do it. Try not to shoot that second arrow. One way that we could translate the first arrow and second arrow into English is sometimes we could say that shooting that the first arrow is pain and the second arrow is suffering. It involves reactivity. Right? That's the key. And I prefer just to talk about reactivity because suffering is sometimes used to mean the same thing as pain. It's confusing in English, right? But that's the idea, that there's some kind of reaction. And I think this is this intention, even if I'm experiencing the unpleasant, it's been triggered by someone's unskillful action, I still take responsibility for my experience. I think there's a similar intention in NBC. And we will explore it some tomorrow, even in the way that we sometimes reframe the ordinary way we talk about what's happening. So one of the things that I think we'll look at more tomorrow when we go into more depth on emotions is we want to be careful with phrasing that appears to be talking about an emotion, but that is actually bringing in interpretations and even the judgmental mind. So we have in English all sorts of ways of saying, I feel this, I feel disrespected, I feel manipulated, right? I feel devalued, right? All these phrases. And the suggestion is that we actually want to, in some ways, that is not taking responsibility for our own experience. And so we actually try to be careful and try to come back to be more precise with what actually is there that is the emotion that's present. In NBC, emotions are understood as particularly grounded in the body, and something that can be rooted in bodily experience. Other people understanding emotions sometimes understand them differently if you look to some of the researchers and so forth, but that's a very helpful very helpful guideline. So three ways of practicing with thoughts and emotions. And again, tomorrow we'll work more with what's in the packet on NBC about this whole range of emotions. And for a lot of us, it can be very helpful just to have, sometimes this happens in meditation, it can also happen in NBC, just to have a much wider vocabulary, to have what Daniel Goleman calls emotional literacy, right? Where we have a much wider vocabulary, of the nuances of emotions and the different kinds of emotions. I think some of the research, this is where, there are a lot of gender issues with when you get into emotions. I think it was the research, if I remember right, when they did research, I forget the year it was done, but they found that men basically had access to very few emotions. The primary one was anger, right? And not very many nuances. And part of what helps us both in our mindfulness practice and our speech practice is to start to become more literate about the range of emotions and what's there and how we can recognize, the differences between whatever frustration and impatience, for example, and really have a more detailed sense of what's there. And so three ways of working with thoughts and emotions. The first one is to come back to balance if we're out of balance. And this is something we've talked about, at least in passing, in terms of certain kinds of experiences, that one of the key questions to ask if we're, you know, whether it's we're just in the flow of everyday experience or whether we're in meditation, is my experience right now, particularly of the thoughts and emotions, is it workable? Can I be relatively balanced with it? Or am I lost in the thoughts and emotions? And this is actually, I think, a question that I believe needs to be asked more in meditative context. You know, that I've known a lot of people who basically know what's happening. Maybe I'm trapped in anger in a certain way, and it's just happening over and over again, and I kind of know it's there, but I'm not really balanced with it, and I just keep on staying with it. And I've heard this happen also sometimes with bodily experiences where some kind of trauma is being relived, right? And that we need to have a certain degree of workability of what's happening. If not, it's wise to try to come back to balance. That's why we sometimes give the guidance here. If it's in the workable range, then can stay with it, but be sensitive to when the activation level is too high. You know, and that's a little bit vague and general, but we can partly know that for ourselves. And probably, you know, we might be able to quantify it in terms of percentage of the time I can be present. You know, if it's pretty low, close to, you know, 10% or zero, and something strong is happening, could be a good sign that what's actually skillful at that time is to come back to balance. And it might be in the meditation, if it's really, really strong, it could be very skillful to actually open the eyes, look around. You know, one of the techniques which can be quite helpful is to look for something, particularly if it's a difficult body sensation or emotion, look to something that's pleasant. Look to something that really feels comfortable and kind of to go there. There are all sorts of other ways to come back to balance. You know, the heart practices like loving kindness, when they're developed enough, can be meditative ways that we come back to balance. I know I've used this a lot, that if I, you know, in times if I've been a little, you know, disturbed with something, and the metta has been developed day by day, really crucial point. The metta has to be strong enough, and I operationally define strong enough as having been practiced at least 10 minutes a day. So it has to be strong enough. Then, because loving kindness is concentration, we can actually use the concentration of the mind to actually, in a way, push away the difficult emotion that's too much. Normally, we don't try to push away things, but when things are too much, that's skillful. So, very crucial point. When emotions are not in the workable range, then we want to come back to balance. Again, we can do it meditatively, we can do it by taking a walk, talking to a friend, coming out of meditation, finding different resources and so forth, doing body practices, yoga, qigong, and so forth. Okay, so that's the first important criteria when things are challenging. And something to remember, you know, at the proverbial 3 a.m. in the morning, waking up, oh my God. Has anyone ever had that happen? Okay, about a third of the group raised their hands. But yeah, it's a very crucial question to ask, is this manageable, workable? Can I be mindful? Can I be present with it? If we can be present and mindful, mindfulness is really a optimal choice. If we can be present with something. Sometimes there are other things we can do, but especially when we're still exploring emotions and thoughts, mindfulness is really crucial. And so mindfulness is a whole second way of working with thoughts and emotions that we can do in meditation We can also just do it on the spot when something comes up. You know, like I know for me, very helpful guidance in situations has just been to ask the old phrase from the 60s and 70s, what's happening? I had a friend who, I don't know whether it was because of drugs or whatever, but all he said for what, like 1 year was, what's happening? I just remembered him. I hope he's okay now. Okay. Okay. It just came out. Okay. But that's something that we can ask on the spot. If our mindfulness is strong enough, we can ask on the spot. Maybe something that I do, maybe many of you do, something happens at a meeting, you get a little disturbed, and you take a pause, either pause in the meeting or maybe you take the bathroom break, right, or something like that. Go outside for a moment and just try to say, what's happening? And try to use mindfulness in the moment. That the value of the pause, again, can save us from that immediate reaction, which is, again, so much happens just from that shooting of the second arrow. Something difficult happened and I just react. We want to do various things which help with that. Mindfulness, tremendous aid. Can use it in the moment, can use it in meditation, things come up. You know, again, helpful to name what's going on, name the thought, name the emotion. A very helpful way of practicing that many of you know, I think, is a method that was originally developed by Michelle MacDonald Smith. At the time, I think, Michelle MacDonald. And this is a method that has been popularized by Tara Brach, by Jack Kornfield, by quite a number of teachers. It's called the method that goes under the acronym RAIN. How many of you know this one? So quite a few, yeah. Yeah, so I'll be brief on it. But this is a very helpful guide to mindfulness and skillful work with thoughts and emotions. And so the R stands typically for recognize, know what's happening, use a label. Again, especially, it's valuable in meditation, but especially valuable in the flow of experience. Again, think of these, you can see how valuable these are even before we say anything, right? Just to know what's happening, to give it a label. I think I mentioned yesterday that I sometimes keep a running log. You know, I'm at a meeting and I have my little mindfulness log and I notice what's going on, and it's very helpful to me to notice, you know, in a given meeting, tired, sarcastic thoughts developing, right? That the noticing of that often helps me to have the choice that we've talked about sometimes, to have that ability to respond rather than just to react. We're looking for all these supports that help us to respond rather than react. That's really at the heart of what we're doing. And so we can recognize the naming, the labeling, very helpful. The second is to acknowledge or accept, accept in the sense that this is a good thing, but accept in the sense that this is really happening, right? I'm sitting at the meeting, I may not want anger to be there, but yes, anger's there. I acknowledge that. Anger's arising in the meeting right now. The third is a really crucial one. This is to inquire or investigate. And this is really at the heart of our mindfulness practice and really crucial. And this is where we can learn so much. And we can do this with mindfulness, and a few different ways that we can practice. So the inquiry may just be to sit with the anger and notice that there's anger, right? Another way that we can sometimes ask, and this is related to the question from the morning about when do we do different kinds of inquiry, we can actually guide ourselves to different aspects of that experience. We can say, I'm experiencing anger. What's it feel like in the body? And tune into how the body feels. We can say, what are the thoughts that are occurring? You know, and see what the narratives are. notice what the narratives are or the thoughts connected with the anger in this case. We can also, with our mindfulness, we can ask a question like, when I stay with the anger, does it move into something else? You know, and so the example of anger is helpful in that, you know, anger often is about some, you know, some need not being met, in particular version of that. And, you know, psychologists, you know, say something very similar often. They say that anger is a cover emotion. It covers up something. It may cover up sadness or frustration or fear. Yeah, and then when we stay, so one way to work with emotions is very helpful in the inquiry part of the process is to see if the emotion moves. Often they will move. They don't stay static. There's changing. And they get into different levels. That's, you know, partly in response to your question. We stay with an experience and different levels of our being open up over time. When I stayed with anger for 10 days in a row, a lot opened up, including material that was younger. You know, it's so there is a way that things just open up like that. So we can inquire, we can do that. We could also ask, this is not in traditional mindfulness instructions, but we could ask, for example, here's this emotion. We could ask, what need is being met or not met? That could be a very helpful inquiry, you know, to work with. The N stands for non-identification, sometimes phrased as not taking it personally, right? Can I just be with the flow of experience? This is really the spirit of mindfulness. Can I be with the flow of experience much as if I was a naturalistic scientist, just observing observing something happening? It's a little bit different with mindfulness because it's actually not that, it's not a kind of distanced observation, but there is that sense of just being, again, we can bring in that sense of both curiosity and care. Can we be curious and caring about this flowing of my own experience? And that, you know, that's actually probably, I think Michelle had a slight addition to her rain phrase. Did you hear about that, Oren?
Raindrop,
so she expanded it. I won't go into that, but I was thinking that one of the dimensions that we would want to bring in would be care, would be that heart of metta, you know, which isn't explicitly in any of those four, right? So this can be a very helpful method for exploring both thoughts and emotions. So what I want to do is right now, after hearing that, let's do a short guided practice, okay? So do any shifting that you need to be able to sit comfortably or be comfortable. So bring to mind an experience in which an important need was met. Maybe that's happened in the last few days or the last week. First, just reflect on experience, and again, we're going to choose experiences more in the middle range, not the most awesome, fantastic experience, but something that was quite positive in the sense of having needs met. maybe at a, on a scale of 1 to 10, in the 5 or 6, maybe 7 range, not the 9s or 10s. Raise your hand if you need a little more time to pick the experience. Okay. Then bring that experience to mind as if you're reliving it. So you can imagine the physical location. If you're with other people, bring them to mind, even bring to mind what they're wearing. Make it real for yourself. And then with the sense that you're reliving the experience to a certain extent, first, bring to your awareness an emotion that might be there, and there might be a few, but tune in to an emotion that's there. And see if you can feel what it's like in the body. Where do you predominantly feel that in the body? Are there thoughts that are connected with this emotion in some way? See if you can tune into the thoughts. They may be general thoughts, might be narratives. What kind of thoughts seem connected? Is there another emotion that's present? If so, you can, again, name it, the R, acknowledge that it's present, and then, much like we did just now, explore it. What does it feel like in the body? What are the thoughts that are connected with this second emotion? If I stay with the emotion for a little while, does it seem to change and other emotions arise? Or does it seem to open up to other thoughts and emotions? can I explore all of this without taking it personally, just very much as if I'm interested and curious and in a sense, whatever is there, I'm interested to see and notice and explore. Can I have that attitude of curiosity and care? And then you can invite this experience to fade away. If you want to just shake a little bit the body to let the experience pass. And then come back just to sitting quietly. Now we'll work with a more challenging type of experience. So again, bring to mind a challenging experience that may have occurred in the last few days, or if you want to go back a week or whatever. And again, on a scale of 1 to 10, something more in the middle. Not the 9s or 10s, but probably something like 4 or 5 or 6. So first, just reflect on which experience you'll focus on. And raise your hand if you need a little more time to come up with the experience. And now, much like we did before, bring that experience to mind as if you're reliving it. Again, it can be helpful to be quite specific, depending if you're visual or not. You can be specific about the locale, where are you, who's there, or you're on your own with others. Bringing some of the visual detail there, or whatever helps you to bring this experience to the present so that you're, in a sense, reliving it. You may have had the experience of remembering what you or someone else said or did. For now, let's work again with the RAIN method. First to notice, is there an emotion that's predominant? If so, first recognize it, give it a name. You just can do one, we can work with one at a time. What does it feel like in the body? Maybe we should go back to the A, just to acknowledge, yes, this is here. Sometimes the acknowledging or the accepting is harder with a challenging emotion. So we recognize, we acknowledge it's here. And then we can inquire or investigate with that spirit of non-identification, the N, not taking it personally. You can do it similarly to how we just worked with the more positive emotion. We can say, let me just feel the emotion in the body. In what part of the body does it seem to be located? Are there thoughts connected with the emotion? What are the narratives or thoughts that are going on? What's the nature of the emotional energy? Does it seem to open up to other emotions? What's the emotional energy feel like? And now again, we can shake out a little bit. Let this experience be shaken out, brought out of our system. And let's just sit quietly for just a little while. We have a little bit of time to share anything that you might have explored or learned in that experience. Any questions about anything that was said about the, you know, some of the methods of working skillfully with thoughts and emotions? And we'll be expanding it. This is sort of an introductory overview of some ways to work with this. We'll keep coming back. Anything you noticed in the exercise?
During the fourth part, the non-identification, I realized that I had a hard time non-identifying because I was really acting upon the sense of responsibility. This is, you know, I'm responsible for this feeling, so then it was difficult to not identify. Do you have any advice for that?
Yeah, so it was a situation in which you felt responsibility?
Not even, it's just responsible for my feelings, just not blaming the other person for the feelings I was feeling.
Oh, you mean my point about being responsible?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
How to combine those two?
Yeah. It actually brings up a good point. By responsibility, I think we're especially meaning the ability to respond when they occur. Not so much the sense that I was the one who caused all this to happen. Right, so that's an important difference, isn't it? Right, so thank you for that, because it's more responsibility in the sense of being able to be skillful with whatever occurs. In the sense, you know, and I mean, I think of this sometimes also in terms of something that may, you know, I think of this in terms of social issues sometimes. There are a lot of things that happened that I wasn't even around when they started, right? You know, that there is racism, sexism, and so forth. In a sense, I can be responsible for that, even though the causes are way in the past. So it's the ability to respond. And so, but we don't sit there thinking, how did I cause that emotion, right? Okay, thanks. Hi.
To deepen that question a bit, because I sort of have the same, with a newer practitioner that I was communicating with, he said or did something, I can't remember, that hurt me, and I said I was hurt by that, and he said, well, I'm not responsible for your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that work?
let me start. It's when we get into how we speak about this, we can be very well-meaning and quite clumsy in our speaking, and so we have responsibility for what we say. And so on, you know, we may be unskillful in how we speak, and we may trigger, you know, someone's self-judgment or something, or trigger something, and the person is not in a sense responsible for your emotions, but the person has, you know, it's important to acknowledge that there is a relationship, you know, we might call it triggering. And people, you know, if I'm a Buddha, if someone insults me right and left, I may be not affected because I'm perfected responsibility or whatever. But the person who's insulting right and left is responsible for that person's, you know, for his or her speech, right, and so forth. So I think that this person was reflecting this, but not really maybe acknowledging what we might call the impact of what was said. And that might not be very skillful. Yeah.
Yes. But how do we, earlier you had said we are responsible for our own feelings.
Yeah.
But if we're being hurt, or feeling hurt, by someone else's actions or words. How does that?
Yeah, I'll say one thing. I think Oren has some things to add. I realize that using the word responsibility, I take some responsibility for having used the word responsibility.
And it is said a lot in NVC.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's the way that I'm holding it is, again, that we have the ability to respond. Meaning, I'm triggered. What's a skillful way for me to work with the situation? Not so much that I'm thinking, oh, what was there in my past that led me to have this feeling, right? It's not so much going there. It's more saying, it's more present-centered. That's a good way to say it. The sense of responsibility is more present-centered. What's a skillful response right now? But the focus or the center is really on how I respond moment to moment. That's why we call it practice, right? It's a sense of how can I respond skillfully whatever has been given me. Yeah. Without blaming someone else for what's there in my experience. That's the spirit of it. You want to add?
Yeah. So two things. One, maybe just a distinction that might be helpful in terms of this thing that this person said, I'm not responsible for your feelings. I would agree with him. He's not responsible for your feelings, but he is responsible to your feelings, which is another way to say what Donald is saying, is that he is responsible for his actions, and then to be able to respond to your feelings. Oh, this had this impact on you. I want to be able to respond to that, to take responsibility for the impact, to respond to the impact. The other thing that's kind of at the heart of both of your questions, which we'll look at more tomorrow, in this sense of like, well, where is the source of our emotions? Is it in the other person's action? From the perspective of NVC, it's not. The other person's action, Donald used the word, triggers the emotion. We might say is the stimulus for the emotion, but the emotion is connected to our needs. It's based on the needs that are met or not met. He might have said the same thing to you on a different day and you would have felt angry and not hurt. He might have said the same thing to you on a third day and you might have felt completely balanced. He might say something to someone else, and they might have a different response. So is it in the thing that he said, or is it in how it meets what's happening here based on what needs are present in us? And so there's that sense, there's a relationship, but it's not a direct relationship. The event doesn't cause the emotional response. The most immediate cause, if we could say, for the emotion is the needs underneath it. What's the needs that are met or not met? And then the event is the stimulus. And so then we can talk about that. You know, when you said this, I felt really hurt because I was wanting more care and respect. That's the because of what, it's because of what I'm wanting. So we'll go into this more tomorrow.
Another way to see that is to know that some things triggered us 5 or 10 years ago, the exact same thing could be said now, and it doesn't, right? Because there's maybe been a certain amount of inner work or healing and so forth. So that can, in a sense, point to the same understanding. Maybe last one, Janet. Let's use the microphone. Where's the...
About responsibility. You'd said, you know, if you say, I feel disrespected, that was not taking responsibility, that you needed to be more specific with that. Can you tell a bit more about that? Because I'm a little confused about that. It's a different kind of responsibility. It's my onus to be more clear. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, I think I'm using, again, responsibility more in the sense of taking every moment as something that I can be skillful with, responsibility in that sense.
See, but I don't understand. Disrespected is too general. Is that disrespected is too general? Is that what you're?
So one way to look at that is that we as practitioners can, as it were, take responsibility for being skillful in our speech, and can actually, again, use language in a way that leads more to connection and understanding. And when one says something like, I felt disrespected, well, especially someone who's empathic and compassionate can understand what's being meant by it and can actually say, well, I have a sense that, you know, how we talk is going to depend on the relationship, but if I'm a practitioner, I can actually rephrase that in a way in which I talk maybe about emotions and needs not being met. I could reframe it like that. And as a listener, when I hear someone speak like that, I can empathically try to reframe and understand that way. But when I say something like that, I feel disrespected. Again, I'm implying causality from the outside. In other words, I'm giving an interpretation that masquerades as an emotion.
Yeah. Yeah, just what he said at the end. It's that words that disrespected, I'm telling a story about what you're doing to me. I feel judged, I feel misinterpreted, I feel attacked. Those aren't emotions. Those are that's blame. That's a story about what you're doing. I'm attributing intention to you as a way of representing my emotional experience. And so to take responsibility means to actually share more clearly, I'm telling myself that you are disrespecting me. That would be taking responsibility. I'm having the thought that you are not respecting me. That's what's actually happening. And on the inside, I feel hurt, angry, scared, frustrated, shocked, any number of emotions.
So a lot of this is actually seeing how some of our habitual language is getting in the way. Right? What? Yeah. I think we're going to have to. We're at time. Very brief. Okay.
Hi. So, yeah, I heard the word. I've heard the word responsibility being used as like response. Two words: response and ability.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like having the responsibility to having the ability to respond.
Great.
So yeah.
That's very, very aligned. And in particular, if we can make the connection between or see that response is opposed to react. And the reaction can be really seen as the shooting of the second arrow. In other words, it's something more automatic, and it particularly comes from in Buddhist tradition, there are two ways of reacting, but the main way that sort of coming up is we react to the presence of the unpleasant. I don't like it, I push it away automatically. In the Buddhist psychology, we would also be reactive when we grab hold of something as well. Yeah.
It's clinging and aversion.
The clinging and aversion, yeah. So we will, yeah, very rich, isn't it? And you can see the subtleties of language, right? Just that even the word responsibility, we have to be careful with that because it can be heard in different ways. Right. So let's just sit for a moment.